Yes, Super Conscious Success fam, welcome back to another chapter reading where we are going to continue on with Buddhism for Mothers. And we're on to chapter 8. We've only got a few more chapters to go. If you haven't yet checked out my other two books, Eckhart Tolle's A New Earth and also his Power of Now, then definitely go ahead and check them out because I think that you'll find them really enjoyable. But I hope that you're enjoying this book as I'm reading it. And this chapter is entitled Finding Happiness and Losing Our Self-Image. So let's get started. Oh, the hours I've spent philosophizing about happiness. How do we find it? How do we keep it? Is it a feeling of complete happiness even possible? So often, any happiness we experience is tinged with anxiety. How can we hold on to this? Do we even deserve this? Do we have any right to be happy when so many live in sorrow? Many have made fortunes from marketing their 10 secrets for happiness. Is there a secret to happiness? One memorable evening, a Buddhist teacher explained what struck me as the first secret of happiness. It was a moment of realization which saw me intensify my commitment to practicing Buddhism. I felt like she had handed me the first piece in the happiness puzzle. She said, "Any happiness we glean from the world outside us is only temporary. Deep and lasting happiness needs to come from within." Reflecting over the moments of peace and happiness in my life, I found this to be true. Happiness from external sources did tend to be temporary and even tinged with anxiety. When my baby Zach was first plonked on my tummy, I'd never known such joy. But soon came the doubts and the worries. Will he survive? Will someone steal him? Could I be a good enough mother? And in no time, this source of happiness was screaming for hours early evening, making me as distraught as I'd ever been. Where we don't find happiness. Happiness comes from within can seem like a tired old cliche. We've all heard it before, but even if we agree, consider how much time we spend seeking happiness from the outside world rather than from within ourselves. For some reason, we always seek happiness from outer sources, incapable of believing the truth that happiness is available to us in any moment. Our lives are rife with desires, expectations, and outright demands on the world. We tell ourselves the world must provide a loving partner, children that make us proud, friends that adore us, a satisfying career, masses of possessions, regular excitement, and that's only the beginning of our demands. If we find unsatisfactoriness in one area, we focus on it and empower it to make us unhappy. If we're fortunate in one of these areas, we may experience great happiness, but it doesn't last. Even if life were meeting our expectations, we'd raise the bar and decide that we must need more. Now that we have acquired the comfortable home, we may as well go for the magnificent home. Then we can be happy. Then we'll know peace once and for all. If only syndrome. We keep deluding ourselves that happiness is just around the corner, but always in the future. If I could just get out of school becomes, if I could only find a better job, which becomes, if I could just find someone to love, and so on, potentially for the rest of our lives. How many of us said, if only I could have children, then I'd be happy? We soon found that children brought us great joy, but also countless hurdles and miseries. With happiness always around the next corner, we could come to the end of our lives to find that we never allowed ourselves to be happy in the present moment, and that we therefore wasted countless opportunities to experience joy. We ceaselessly categorize our experiences into good or bad, then we try to arrange our lives so that we can avoid the bad and attract the good. Despite these efforts, we live in failure. As any Zen Buddhist will tell you, life presents 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. We must meet pain as well as pleasure, so we can't afford to hook our happiness to external circumstances. In our clearer moments, we may glimpse what's going on. This endless pursuit of transitory happiness seems futile, but what can we do? Rather than acknowledge the inner deprivation, we try harder in the outer world because we obviously need more of what it can offer. We might convince ourselves we need a world trip, an affair, or an exciting career change, and we're back in a cycle of demanding from the outside world. We run about in a frenzy and may manage to distract ourselves from our inner world, but eventually we find the need to make some time to stop doing and simply be. As Buddhist writer Sylvia Boorstein called one of her books, "Don't just do something, sit there," meditation and mindful living reconnect us with our inner selves. We learn to seek our happiness from within instead of linking it to external circumstances, we'll find strength to face the challenges life hurls at us. The challenge is to stop looking outside ourselves for happiness. We need to start an inner journey. Happiness or the lack of it can be an issue that mothers feel desperate to resolve. This is especially the case on the arrival of a second child. Parenting magazine Sydney's Child reported the results of a study which found a woman's life satisfaction falls to its all-time low the year after the birth of her second child. Another study found that many second-time mothers had stress levels high enough to warrant medical treatment. Mothers spend so much time attending to the have-tos of life, housework, errands, paperwork, phone calls, taxiing, appointments, birthdays. We need to give all our family members quality time and maintain contact with a string of relatives. Our brains are shuffling so many details that they feel close to exploding. With family responsibilities, we are far less free to seek our own happiness. We have less time for our careers, hobbies, and friends, and we may discover that a family holiday is a contradiction in terms. At times, any hopes of happiness for a mother is quashed by a baby's bellowing, a toddler's tantrums, a daughter's sleep problems, a son's antisocial behaviour, or workplace inflexibility. There's no end to the hoops our children and others can put us through. At times, happiness is the most distant of our dreams, and we humbly confine our wishes to a little peace and quiet. Certainly, a mother has a new source of happiness from the world outside her, watching her children grow into little characters, laughing at their capers, perhaps a new circle of friends. Still, she may find herself in the cycle of postponing happiness, wishing, if I could just have them all at school, if we could only get through this stage, if they would just move out. We sometimes catch more experienced mothers musing. They grow up so quickly, don't they? Some of us don't believe them, but still, this period of our lives will pass, and this makes it precious. Buddhist writer and mother Anne Cushman understands this. Could there be any better way to get my nose rubbed in the truth of impermanence than to love a child in a jagged, careless world? And even if everything goes absolutely perfectly, I know that this particular sky, the one who warbles and passionately sucks on the bill of his rubber duck as he splashes with me in the tub, is going to dissolve like bubble bath. Yesterday he was a kicking bulge in my belly as I swam laps in the July sun. Tomorrow he'll be a middle-aged man weeping and scattering my ashes in a mountain lake. See appendix for her account of mothering a newborn from a Buddhist perspective. In postponing our happiness until the children are older, we lose sight of the importance of this stage of our lives. When we're older, perhaps as we leaf through a photo album brimming with images from their childhood, we might regret that we never allowed ourselves to enjoy our small children as much as we could have. The studies keep finding that the first few years of life are the most important as a child's psychological and intellectual development. Another reminder of the preciousness of our moments with young children. The self-image quandary. Before we had children, we could arrange our lives to include activities that nourished our self-image. If we didn't have satisfying careers, we could always pursue other interests in our search for fulfillment and a sense of identity. We were young and felt as though we were always would be. Although we were never completely trouble-free, life was a lighter experience, offering myriad distractions from the problems of the world. It was easier to hide from that first noble truth that there is suffering and unsatisfactoriness. Aging, sickness, and death were the last things on our mind. Now we find ourselves with children. Many of us have wound down our careers and it's hard to find time to indulge in interests outside work and family. We might find ourselves questioning, who am I? And feel like we don't know anymore. How do we piece together a self-image now? Although there are exceptions, these wonderful born-to-mother types, most of us find responding to the demands of our children all day long does little to bother our self-image. A friend informed her demanding 3-year-old daughter, I'm not your slave, only to be assured, yes you are. There are times when we feel proud to call ourselves mothers, when we feel like we've got it all. But sometimes our self-image comes under severe attack as our child-rearing problems overwhelm us or we see our lifestyle as one of unrelenting sacrifice. We've all heard mothers lament, I get so little time to myself and when I do I'm so exhausted I can't use it. My career is finished. All I do is respond to the needs of others, and at worst, I don't know who I am anymore. All symptoms of a self-image under siege. As my Buddhist friend Joanne put it, in the months after my second child was born, as I felt the self I once knew recede beyond recalling, I thought perhaps this is what going mad must feel like. And in the months that followed, I watched helplessly as the perfect mother in me died a quick and horrible death. How can a mother foster a positive self-image in a day filled with activities that stimulate children, a day filled with chores, appointments and errands? Many seek the answer in work, but how reliable a source of self-image are our jobs? We may be in a job that does more to damage our self-image than prop it up. Or our working conditions could change overnight and the source of our self-image dry up. Moreover, the juggle of kids and work may lead us to feel like we do neither job well. What does Buddhism have to say on the issue? It takes two words to sum up the Buddhist position on self-image. Drop it. In fact, Buddhism goes as far as to saying that your self-image, your insistence that you exist in some kind of stable, consistent and permanent form, is making you miserable. The pursuit of identity. Our craving for an identity is a burden. We feel that we can only be happy if we are worthy and valuable. We compile mental lists of our good points and bad points and constantly monitor our performance. We demand that we be different from how we see ourselves now. Not many people would want to admit that their aim in life is to create a positive self-image. It's like saying, I invest most of my energy in trying to feel really proud of myself. Although this doesn't sound very admirable, if we look at many of our thoughts and behaviours, this is what they reveal. It's possible we devote most of our lives to fulfilling the craving for a positive self-image. How often do we find ourselves striving to be the perfect mother, worker, homemaker, no matter what the cost to our health and sanity? Feeling guilty when we don't meet our expectations? Comparing ourselves with others? Worrying about others' opinions of us? Overreacting at even the hint of criticism? And seeking others' approval? It could be on our deathbeds that we finally realise, I spent my whole life searching for self-esteem, there must have been a better way to live. The Buddhist perspective would be, why bother chasing a positive self-image when you don't even have a self? That is to say, there is no essential you in any stable, consistent or ongoing way. The teaching of no self may at first seem outrageous, but after you investigate it, you may be surprised at how much it rings true. Who are you anyway? If it were possible to write down the script of your thoughts, would it read like the monologue of one actor? Or would it be more like reading a script for several actors, each with a distinct agenda? Consider this mother's train of thought. Maybe I should call Anne for a chat. She's probably a bit lonely on her own. I've just got so much to do though, I don't really have time. She's always been a good friend to me though, and I should be more caring. I don't really feel that chatty actually, I'm a bit tired. I must call the accountant. It's as if our minds contain several personalities. There's the voice that makes suggestions, the voice that vetoes action, the voice that forces you to consider others' feelings. There's a whole committee of personalities competing for dominance. These competing voices may plunge you into confusion and indecision, or you may obey the loudest one and deal with the others later. Which voice is yourself? All the voices exist in your own head, yet they all seem to have different personalities. Listening to the chatter that takes place in our minds, do we find one voice that we could consider as consistent over time? Could it be that our tendency to see ourself as one coherent entity is a delusion? The search for a self. Buddhism challenges us. How rational is it to believe in an ongoing, stable self at all? For starters, how would you define the self? What exactly is it? Would you use descriptive labels? I am impatient and pessimistic, but also affectionate and sociable. To describe ourselves with these labels assumes that we have personality traits that don't change over time. Yet our tendency to be impatient, affectionate, or any other quality varies from one day to the next. None of these qualities is locked in for life. Perhaps we could define ourselves as a result of our past experiences, but that puts us at the mercy of memory, which is notoriously unreliable. It's human nature to fiddle with our past. Some memories we suppress, others we relive many times, distorting them in the process. We edit our memories, embellish them, and create convenient details that might never have existed. Besides, if faced with the same events a few years later, we might have completely differently and create entirely different stories. Even if we had perfect memories, our past experiences don't define us. We may have been victimized at school, but it's our choice whether we identify with such experiences and become card-carrying victims for the rest of our lives. So could we define ourselves as the roles we play? When we go to social functions, people ask us, what do you do? To get some insight into who we are. Yet what we do hardly provides a complete picture, especially if we don't like our job. Neither could we define ourselves by the roles loving partner, loyal daughter, or competent mother. Our capacity or desire to play any of these roles day in and day out over time varies enormously. We have a body which appears to be separate from others and the rest of the world. But could we see this body as being a stable, consistent self? The changes that our bodies undergo from birth to death, along with the fact that we shed and renew cells all the time, certainly suggests that the body is no place to look for a permanent, unchanging self. A new meditator decides to concentrate on their breath, only to find that a dozen different voices from their own mind interrupt them. Thoughts run off in ever-changing and confusing directions. They are surprised to find that their self is not in control here. Just as when they sleep, they, or their self can neither control nor remember their dreams. The possible sources of our sense of self are plentiful. Which one should we choose? We may look to other people to define ourself and feel devastated when they don't like us. Sometimes we feel our self is what we see in the mirror. If we look less than attractive, then we feel less worthwhile and less valuable. Maybe we are what we eat or what we have written in our diaries or how we behaved yesterday. Are we our resumes or are we the images in our photo albums? None of these and all of these. The more we speculate, the more complex it becomes to find a way to define self. The findings. So we find that coming up with a watertight definition of ourself is impossible. We are, in fact, a collection of bits and pieces that do not fit together in any logical way. They contradict each other and change constantly. You, yourself, cannot be found and therefore cannot be relied on for a sense of stability. Rather than being a stable object, the self is a collection of interactive processes, constantly transforming, a set of verbs rather than nouns or adjectives. Any sense of self we may have is an invention, as the Buddha realized as he sat under his tree. The being which I believed in was a fictional construction. I have a name, a personal history, memories, thoughts, emotions, and dreams, but when I look, they are quite illusory. The message here seems to be that we are not who we think we are, that we have no idea of who we really are. We simply don't exist in the way we think we do. Despite the lack of conclusive evidence for a self, we act in ways that protect our fragile ego, constantly seeing the world in terms of I, my, and mine. Buddhism teaches us that this quest for a self makes us miserable. Let it go. Yet it is such a habit, so automatic, that it's difficult to give up. Many Buddhists believe the teachings of no self should be taught with great caution, presented at the level of understanding of the listener in case we misunderstand. For example, we might believe we don't exist or don't matter, and therefore that nothing could matter. In this way, Buddhism might be misinterpreted as promoting indifference and withdrawal from life, which is not the message of the Buddha at all. The teaching is complex and counterintuitive, and we each need to explore it further for ourselves. The good news on no self. Part of us feels threatened by the concept of no self, believing that it undermines all our striving to become the person we are today. Having a self is familiar territory. We are used to thinking in this way, and it would take a revolution of the mind to dispense with the notion. Another part of us may respond to this teaching with relief. Finally, we can give up our torturous efforts to define ourselves, to protect and defend our contrived self-images. Who needs a precious self-image anyway? Now we can identify and do away with all our restrictive self-definitions. I hate parties, for example. I say what people expect me to say. I avoid risk. I must visit my relatives. I mustn't waste money. All the rules that we've used in the past and that serve to restrict our behavior become irrelevant. Understanding that we have a true nature, our Buddha nature, behind our false perception of who we are, is to walk out of our cage. At first, the idea of having no self could be disconcerting. Is there any need to behave, to act responsibly if there is no self to govern behavior? But Buddhism teaches that in shedding the delusion of a self, we uncover our true nature, our Buddha nature, which is one of wisdom and compassion. This then allows us to ask, what does this moment require, rather than how do I respond to such moments, and to meet each new moment with a freshness, a beginner's mind free of prejudice. As mothers, this is what we do when we are at our best, as Susan Murphy explains. Parenting will call into question virtually everything we think we know, beginning with who we think we are. We're not. Children have an extraordinary talent for breaking apart our roles, demanding again and again that we meet them right in the moment, meet our lives, meet difficulty, moment by moment, meet and resolve the extraordinary mystery of the other. To do this, we must time and again lose our precious adult facades and have recall or regain access to the mysterious and creative core that has no name, the source, that we brush again and again in meditation. The delusion that we are independent or separate and cut off from others and all that is outside me also arises from this false notion of self. Our attachment to an ego disconnects us from those around us, and we overlook the reality that we are all one, a connected, interdependent whole. And importantly, our false perception of a separate self is the main obstacle in cultivating the Buddhist mind of love. When our life is focused on ourselves and what's ours, we are blocked from seeing the needs of others. We fall prone to using others as report cards on how likable or powerful we are, or on how many people love us. We treat others according to what they do for us or how they make us feel. Ironically, the self-oriented approach does not make us happy. Our obsession with the self may hinder us from truly listening to others. When we are self-conscious, self-absorbed, or seeking self-esteem, we miss many chances to talk with others in meaningful and helpful ways. We may overlook opportunities to help others even when helping them might not take much effort. It's hardly any trouble to mind our friend's child when she needs some time to herself, but caught up with our own concerns, we don't think to offer. It takes no effort to offer reassurance to a suffering relation, but absorbed in self, we turn the conversation topic to our own experience. That's just like me. The problem now is that we've grown so conditioned to carting this self around that it takes time and great effort to dispense with it. Even if we've come to an intellectual understanding of the concept of no self, living this is another matter. At a surface level, we may understand how our sense of self sabotages us, but we must achieve insight on a deep level before we can experience the full power of this teaching. This can only happen through meditation and the mindfulness that it brings. Mirror, mirror, don't do this to me. For women, no discussion on self-image would be complete without a reference to the image that stares back at us from our mirrors. The shallow consumer culture that we live in does its utmost to tell us that who we are, our self, and our worth is what we look like. High school culture reinforces this for most of us, and even now it's very rare to meet a woman who has learned to accept the way she looks, let alone the fact that she's aging. And nothing speeds up the aging process like having children. If we didn't put on weight during our pregnancies or time spent at home feeding infants, most of us at least have some deepened wrinkles testifying to how much sleep we've lost. My friend Rachel, who occasionally emails me her articles, agonises about her physical decline. I'm ageing, not drastically, but at 35, I don't exactly look youthful, and with the decay ahead, I need to find a way to get used to it. I've had the babies and the sleepless nights babies bring, and now it's written all over my face and my body. What's really bothering me is how much time I agonise over my appearance. With a toddler and a baby who won't grant me leave to develop my mind, I've managed to find time to frown into the mirror, although you generally should avoid frowning as it only deepens wrinkles. When you're not glowering in the mirror, you're gazing into the perfect faces of children, coveting their flawless skin and soft hair. My mind once abounded with worthy thoughts. Now I find myself thinking about open pores, thinning hair and crow's feet, not to mention my complete failure at abdominal reform. Last night my husband told me that I needed support. He didn't mean emotional. I am cursed with a catwalk gorgeous sister. She got married recently and her wedding was a celebration of female beauty. After looking through 2,005 zillion wedding photos where I, the bridesmaid, looked like some demented cousin, I knew I hadn't been worrying about my appearance for nothing. I panicked and started consulting plastic surgeons with my 13 suggestions for procedures. I even went through with one procedure, although nobody has spotted the change. I can see an improvement. As with all life's problems, aging gives us an opportunity to deepen our wisdom. As our youth slips away, Buddhist teachings can help us. Facing aging. As Rachel's case illustrates, we resist the inevitable process of changing in our body. It's not that it's wrong to keep fit, buy eye creams, or even undergo plastic surgery. According to Buddhism, the problems start when we develop feelings of attachment to the ideas of youth and beauty, when we chase them graspingly and believe they could make us happy in any lasting way. The attachment, according to the second noble truth, is what makes us suffer. We may even be capable of seeing how our attachment makes us suffer, yet still refuse to give it up. We may see that our attachment damages our relationships with others, just as Rachel is aware of her jealousy for a sister. So many of our attachments or desires are based on the delusion of having a self. Rachel craves youth and beauty to feed her self-esteem, even though the endless pursuit of self-esteem is hardly the road to happiness. She deludes herself that she'll feel some peace if she can reform her abdomen, but she must know deep down that this is unlikely to be the case. A washboard stomach would allow her to feel some relief that she no longer has this desire, but the feelings of relief would fade and she'd focus on her double chin or her thighs. Examining our anxiety about aging reveals a Buddhist truth about all unhappiness and suffering. It is not always the suffering itself that makes us miserable so much as our resistance to it. Love handles and furrowed foreheads don't actually hurt us. In some cultures, they would even deliver us status and respect. It's our aversion to aging that makes us miserable. The energy we invest in avoiding it, the time we spend fearing it, is the way we tell ourselves that if we could only get rid of our crow's feet, we'd feel so much better. It's the way we feel self-conscious with others, certain that they're examining our decay. We choose for ourselves how painful the experience of aging will be. Are we going to resist the inevitable, panic, grieve, become gloomy? Or will we do what we can do to look our best and then get on with our lives? As the Buddhist author Sylvia Boorstein so wisely states, suffering is inevitable, but pain is optional. This is not to say that we need to deny or suppress our true feelings about aging. If aging is a painful experience, then we need to explore those feelings and get to the root of them. What beliefs do we cherish on the subject and how rational are they? Is the issue really how we look, or are there deeper issues to deal with, such as loneliness, the need for control over the uncontrollable, or just a painful sense of inadequacy? As any Buddhist teacher will tell us, acceptance is the only approach to a process, aging, of which we ultimately hold little control. Facing death. Resisting aging is like resisting death. Morbid as it sounds, they're both going to catch us, so why live in denial? Living in awareness of the certainty of aging and death is a priority for Buddhists. It's a way of embracing the concept of impermanence. Some women become suddenly and painfully aware of their own mortality through the experience of motherhood. As my Buddhist friend Joanne describes, the agony of my labour experience made me face for the first time that I would die one day, and it terrified me because I couldn't bear the thought of leaving my child without a mother. I felt a renewed need to take care of myself, but my awareness of mortality was heightened further by the vulnerability of the newborn. Feeling blessed with abundance only increased my terror. I was very aware that this baby would someday die. I'd given birth to a being with a finite life. These realizations were very hard-hitting for me. In our culture, it is seen as bizarre to dwell on moribund thoughts. Death makes us feel uncomfortable, so we avoid reflecting on it. But given death is the only certainty in life, maybe it's worth more attention. If we allowed our mind to dwell for a while on what it would be like to lose the use of one's leg, it would make us appreciate having two. If we forced ourselves to reflect on sickness for a few moments, it would make us appreciate our good health. In the same way, if we regularly consider the certainty of our own death, we learn to appreciate life. With death in mind, we are likely to use our lives more thoughtfully. Most of us have heard of people who, after a near-death experience, realised how precious their lives were and made dramatic changes. They stopped taking life for granted and decided to use their time more productively. They realised what matters and what is mere froth. To remind themselves of the certainty of death, some Buddhists make their first thought on waking, "Wow, I made it through the night without dying." Some recite a mantra, "Birth, aging, pain and death." Others meditate on the degeneration of their bodies or on death itself. They envision their bodies buried in the ground and picture the skin slowly rotting, the bones gradually disappearing. All these practices make it easier to remember our impermanence. I'm not sure if women's magazines will ever embrace such ideas, but maybe a more realistic and accepting approach to death could help us cope with the inevitability of aging. Insight. When I was a teenager with frizzy hair and pimples, my mother, after assuring me I was beautiful, pointed out, but if you look at the people at the train station, in the bank queue, on the street, only a tiny proportion of them are beautiful in any commercial sense. My own surveys found her to be right, and yet these plain members of the public probably belong to loving families. Some of them have stimulating careers, others hobbies that make their hearts sing. If pressed, Rachel would probably admit that ordinary looking people can find what they aspire to, and that youth and beauty are not the way to everlasting peace and happiness. She might remember the high rate of despair and self-destructive behaviour exhibited by the world's beautiful celebrities. She might acknowledge some of the problems that beauty brings, such as envy and being loved not for who you are but how you look. Insight, or the ability to see what is, helps us to see when our thoughts and actions are out of sync with what we know to be true. Although we can see a truth plainly with our intellect, such as beauty doesn't bring happiness, we often act in a way that suggests we don't understand the truth at all. We need to pay close attention to our thoughts so that we can identify these mismatches between what we know to be true and how we live. Of equal importance is the need to pay attention to the beliefs and assumptions we cling to, for these are often the cause of our problems. For example, on reflection, Rachel might uncover the assumptions, "Beauty will bring me peace. If I pay enough, I can avoid aging. And with a disciplined beauty regime, I can stay young." She might identify the demand she makes on life. "To be worthwhile, I have to look good. My husband must find me attractive and tell me so, and expensive beauty treatments must work." Take diets. The world of dieting is an excellent example of how we ignore the underlying issues. We know diets don't work and that all we lose is some faith in ourselves. We become so obsessed with our dream body shape that we have no idea of the answers to the more important underlying questions. Why do I feel inadequate in the first place? Would my unpleasant feelings be forever resolved by mere slimness? How rational is it to base my self-acceptance on a body shape? What thoughts trigger my overeating? And why does my body feel uncomfortable? And can eating fix it? If Rachel could explore her unspoken assumptions and demands, she might find that they, not her appearance, are the cause of her dissatisfaction. Most Buddhist traditions argue that thinking our way to insight with our scatty, unreliable thought processes will not always be effective. It's thinking that plunges us into our mental messes, so it might not be the best tool for cleaning them up. The most effective path to insight, they argue, is to use the clear-mindedness of meditation where you can transcend the rational thinking mind and see your thoughts for what they are. When we see our delusions clearly, our misconceptions and bad habits disappear effortlessly. If this doesn't happen, or if our delusions resurface, it only means we haven't seen our misconceptions clearly enough. To pay attention to our thoughts as they arise is exceedingly difficult, especially for beginners. Anyone who has tried meditating knows that we all suffer from monkey minds that jump around and seem to live a chaotic life of their own, well beyond our control. To increase our attention span takes discipline and patient hours of meditation. As we practice meditation over time, our minds become clearer and more disciplined so we can achieve the insights that can transform our experiences and hence our lives. So there you go, finding happiness. As you can see, happiness is found within, not without. So you can't base other people's views of you or how other people behave as your guide towards your own happiness. So I hope that you've really enjoyed that chapter. We've only got two more chapters to go in this book. If you want to get the tips for the what can we do, which is at the end of every single chapter in this particular book, then go to superconsciousSuccess.com/innercircle and sign up for it. It's absolutely free, but it will have all the tips for all the books that I've read, all the summaries and free courses and all sorts of things. So definitely head across there now and sign up. And I look forward to bringing you chapter 9 very shortly. Okay, bye.